Evidence and Answers begins right now.
This is Evidence and Answers radio broadcast with our host, Pat Zukeran. Pat is an author, teacher, and international speaker in the area of Christian apologetics, the defense of the Christian faith. Were the rulers named in the Gospels real people or merely literary figures? Using their 4Ds method, discovery, description, dwelling, and denotation, Dr. Joseph Holden and Dr. Pat Zukeran evaluate the archaeological evidence connected to Herod, Pontius Pilate, and Caiaphas. The findings demonstrate that the New Testament accurately identifies historical persons, offices, and locations, strengthening confidence in the gospel accounts. If you've missed any part of this broadcast, log on at evidenceandanswers.org, and there you will find this discussion entitled Herod, Pontius Pilate, and Caiaphas. Plus, you'll find hundreds more podcasts that you may download or listen online. Now let's get right into part two of this fascinating discussion.
And we see that Jesus was taken to Caiaphas's house where the Sanhedrin gathered. It was probably a compound where Annas lived as well. And they brought false witnesses against Jesus. And this is all at the instigation of the high priest Caiaphas. And Caiaphas was also the one who asked Jesus directly if he was the Son of God. And Jesus, of course, affirms that he is the Son of God. And then Jesus goes on to tell him that he will sit at God's right hand and come in the clouds of heaven. And Caiaphas tears his robe and throws dirt in the air and is just, broken apart by Jesus's claims here. And then ultimately, it's Caiaphas who leads the council that condemns Jesus ultimately to death. So Herod the Great, Pontius Pilate, Caiaphas, all three men have great authority. They feature prominently. And these are the people who really formed that tripart progression to get Jesus condemned and ultimately crucified.
Great, great biblical overview. So Pat, Joe has provided now a historical overview, kind of giving us the footprint these three men had in history. And now he just gave us the biblical footprint, if you will. And of course, they were very important, not only from the biblical narrative, but a historical narrative. So this leads us to our fourth denotation. Why is this significant that the Bible and history are in agreement and that archaeology is really demonstrating that the Bible is historically reliable?
Yeah, Brian. You know, if the Gospels are historically reliable, I mean, you don't even have to believe in inerrancy or the divine inspiration of the Bible. But I mean, if the Bible is historically reliable, then it gives us a trustworthy testimony, a historical record of the life of Christ, you know, who claimed to be the divine Son of God and confirmed his claim to his miraculous life and resurrection from the dead. So if the New Testament is historically reliable, Christianity is true. And so discoveries like these affirm the people named in the Gospels are real historical people. And the Gospels, you know, not only identify their names, but, you know, as Joe was talking about here, their office, their government position, the location of where they live, the time frame, the Bible gets it right. And if it gets it right on these people, how much more the main character, Jesus Christ? Not long ago, I was debating one of the most popular atheist groups, the Rational Response Squad, and their argument was that Jesus was a myth. And yet I pointed out, look, you believe Herod was a real historical person? They said, yes, Pontius Pilate, Caiaphas, and others. And I said, well, if the Bible gets it right on these guys, how much more the main character, you know, of Jesus Christ? And it's getting the cultural and historical details right on guys that oppose Christ. Well, then we can be reasonably sure that indeed when it talks about its main character, Jesus Christ, the Bible gets it right.
Yeah, so good. You know, what's interesting on that whole notion of Christ is a myth, you know, even critics of the Bible or higher critics, someone like Bart Ehrman, who just retired from his position there on the East Coast, he would even say, well, no, Jesus did live. You know, they reinterpreted, or they said legendary aspects around his life arose. But I find it really hard to believe that there's still people out there that would actually believe that Jesus didn't exist, even when, you know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, most scholars would say unquestionably, you know, there's a preponderance of historical evidence for that. Is that your thought as well, Pat?
Yes. Yeah, even skeptics and critics that deny the resurrection, and even 80% of the Gospels, like you mentioned, Bart Ehrman, John Dominic Crossan, and others acknowledge Jesus as a real historical person.
Yeah, so good. Thanks for that, Pat. Well, Joe, what's interesting is, you know, and this is always the case with books. You write a book, as you and Norm did, on archaeology, and it's published in a certain time, but archaeology continues. You know, you, when you wrote the book, you wrote it and you were talking about those archaeological excavations and findings that happened up till the time of when you wrote it. Well, lo and behold, archaeology continues. The science of archaeology really does continue to unearth new things. So my question for you is, what continual archaeological research and excavations on either or all three of these men have continued, and what have they discovered since the time you wrote your book?
Well, it's so interesting how archaeology progresses. And our book, what I wrote with Dr. Geisler back in 2014, we focused on those artifacts and those issues in archaeology that were confirmed, they were vetted, and you could take it to the bank. But archaeology has continued. And one of the great and exciting things that just occurred just last year in April was that archaeologists from Sapienza University in Rome, they worked together with the Israeli Antiquity Authority, and they uncovered underneath the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem a Roman garden dated to the first century AD, at the time Jesus was ministering. Ultimately, it was a time before Hadrian, which was about 130 AD. This garden was in play, and as you know, the Bible tells us that Jesus was buried in a garden in a new tomb. And what they have found there was that this garden contained a low stone wall. It contained olives and vine seeds and pollen, and it confirmed the agricultural use of that area in the first century. So it makes the whole story of Jesus being buried in a garden in that new tomb very plausible, even reliable. And the different archaeologists, in fact, there's a certain branch of archaeology called archaeobotanical archaeology, which analyzes different plants and seeds and so forth. And they found that there was grains and grapes and figs, and this all aligns very well with the green area that Christ was buried in, very close to Golgotha, the crucifixion site. And as you know, most of our listeners understand that the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, where this was found, is one of the possible places where Jesus was buried in his tomb. This whole discovery by Sapienza University and the IAA in Israel is really bringing in a newfound attention and confirmation of the location as possibly being where Jesus was ultimately buried. And then you have, on a different note, the Pilgrim's Road that has just been opened up to tourists because they've been working on it for the last couple years. This is a road that led from the Pool of Siloam in the city of David all the way up to the southern steps of the Temple Mount. And they saw by accident, they were trying to do some infrastructure repairs, and they uncovered some stone steps, and they followed them. And it's this path that led from the southern steps of the Temple Mount down to the Pool of Siloam. And immediately you think of John chapter 9, where Jesus healed the blind man, and he puts mud on his eyes, and he says, go wash in the Pool of Siloam, and you'll see. And people think, why would he send a blind man across town to go wash in the Pool of Siloam? Why didn't he just do it there? Didn't that seem a little insensitive to the blindness of this poor man, has to go trek around town? Well, the path would take you directly from where he was healed, just stay on the path, directly to the Pool of Siloam, where he would wash and ultimately be healed. It's open to tourists today. Some people, maybe listening to our program even now, have already walked that path. And it's called the Pilgrim's Road. It's down in the city of David, and it's the ancient path that Jesus or pilgrims would have taken to go up to the Temple Mount from that area to access the southern gates of the Temple Mount. And then other finds, like in 2024, they found a massive industrial scale quarry site discovered in the area of Jerusalem. And it likely provided the stone that was needed for Herod and his massive building projects all around Jerusalem and abroad. And then you have the Western Wall tunnels. And of course, the tunnel system has been open to tourists for many years, but they're continuing to excavate in the Western Wall tunnels. And they're finding all kinds of massive stones and ritual baths that function during the temple period, during the time of Jesus and so forth. So archaeology is progressing, especially this garden beneath the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the Pilgrim's Road path that led from the temple to the Pool of Siloam, the quarrying sites that Herod most likely used for his building projects, the Western Wall Tunnel, which is an ongoing excavation, are yielding more and more artifacts that again confirm the historical reliability of the Bible.
Yeah, I love that. You know, you pointed out that you finished your book in 2014, and just in these last 10 plus years, all these new discoveries, all these new things that, again, demonstrate the reliability of the Bible. Pat, I'm just going to switch it up here a little bit because, you know, Joe mentioned some of these new digs going on. And I know you have been to the Middle East, you know, fairly recently in the last several years to take part in some of these digs. Give our listeners an idea of what you actually do on these digs and what would be the day-to-day, you know, kind of schedule of someone who is on an excavation site. You know, so many of us have been brought up on Indiana Jones, and we think, you know, you're running away from tribes and running away from boulders, but that's not the reality of archaeology. So give us an idea. Let's say someone was digging in the Western Wall tunnels or the Herodium Fortress. What exactly are you doing?
Yeah, you know, famous archaeologist named Kathleen Kenyon developed the Kenyon method of archaeology. Before, archaeologists would just go in and, you know, with a bulldozer or something and just rip out a big section, you know, like a piece of a cake, and just see what is there. And that was a very destructive method of archaeology. Well, she designed a method that was much more precise, but much more tedious. And she created this method in which you have these squares. And so when you see archaeological digs, you see 10 by 10 meter squares, and they all go down together at the same time, scraping from the top and going down layer after layer. And so when you get to an archaeological site, and they're all over Israel, I mean, you go almost anywhere and you run into an archaeological dig. There's so much archaeology going over there. But, you know, you find a archaeological excavation or a dig that you're interested in, you contact the director of the dig and you'll go there. The dig season is about May to June, just only 2 months. So that's your window there. And when you go, the director will give you a tour of what's going on. And then you'll be assigned to one of those squares, and you'll have a square supervisor, and he'll give you some instruction and what is they're finding in that square. And then you start digging, and you got to dig carefully, because once your shovel or your spade makes a different kind of sound, you've hit something, maybe a pot, maybe a part of a wall. Some people get the excitement of finding, you know, a coin or a plaque of some sort. Or, you know, maybe part of a piece of furniture. We found all of those there at Shiloh where we were digging just last year. And so you'll spend the day, you'll probably start at the rise of the sun, 5, 6 a.m. And then you'll probably end about 2 p.m. because it gets pretty hot out there. But you'll be digging, you'll be scraping, you'll be using the shovel, looking for the bottom of a particular layer, maybe a wall. Or if you're lucky, you might find a whole pot. You rarely find a whole jar. Usually it's just sherds, you know, pieces, but you might, I found a whole 5-foot jar. Of course, it was broken. They put it back together, but I found one in my square. It was really exciting. But that's the kind of things you're going to do. Dig, and then you put all that dirt and rocks in a bucket, and then you sift it because you might find something really valuable that's tiny in there, like a coin or something, maybe a piece of a ring or jewelry. You sift it and you look at it, and then at the end of the day, the whole team goes down and you wash all the pottery and artifacts that you've discovered. So that's kind of what you can expect when you go on a dig there in Israel.
Yeah. And Joe, you're planning on going out, Lord willing, this summer to Shiloh, but you've also been on excavations in the past. And what were some of your experiences?
Oh, it was a fantastic experience. I brought my two boys with me. They were about 10 and 12 at the time, and they even discovered some intact, real small, kind of pyriform chlorine pottery that almost looked like it was in mint condition. They were so thrilled, dated back to the time of Abraham and so forth. We were thrilled. Just like Pat described, you know, you get a square, you get familiar with your team, you start troweling and getting those guffas and hauling the dirt out, and that dirt needs to be sifted and so forth. And sifting is very productive. You can find all kinds of things, such as bulla, which are stamp seals with names on it and titles and family names and so forth. And the rich material that came from the Temple Mount area was trucked to a different site. That all had to be sifted as well by Gabriel Barkey and Zaki Zweg in Israel, and that's where they found the Immer Bulla. Immer was the family name of those priestly families that were ruling the Temple Mount area at the time of Jeremiah, the prophet. So it's just so rewarding. I was thrilled. I learned so much, and can't wait to get out to Shiloh either this summer or next. It's going to be amazing.
Yeah, I've only been fortunate enough to be here on our U.S. excavations, and they really are exciting. I mean, for people who have never been on an excavation dig, you really should. They really are just informational, interesting. And when you do discover something, as I did here, you look at it and go, boy, I'm the first person in, you know, possibly 1,000 years in the case of the Middle East, you know, 2,000, 3,000 years that no one has seen this. So it really is, there's an excitement about all of this. Well, before we get to our book, let's just kind of wrap this all up, Pat. You know, what does all of this archaeology, you know, you're studying archaeology, you're getting your PhD in archaeology. What does this really tell us about the whole orb of the biblical worldview and the reliability of what we're accomplishing when we are digging in the dirt?
Yes, you know, Brian, archaeology confirms the historical reliability of the Bible. And if the Bible is historically reliable, then our faith in Christ is indeed true. And through archaeology, we can confirm that the Bible accurately names people, their office, and their titles. I mean, it gives you details like that. And when it accurately describing details about the people that it mentions in the Bible, you can be reasonably sure you've got a reliable historical record here. But also, the buildings that are described in the Old and New Testament, we have found them, and the architecture reflects what the Bible records. The Bible describes the geography and the landscape accurately that we have confirmed there through archaeological digs and discoveries. The political structure, the religious atmosphere, you know, what's going on at that time, as described in the Old and New Testament, archaeology confirms. The Bible describes the culture and the practices of the times, and archaeology confirms these details that the Bible records. So all of this, you know, adds up. It builds a cumulative case to show us that the Bible is indeed historically accurate. We can compare this to like putting a witness on the stand. You know, you got a reliable witness if he can describe the event and the details around it. And lawyers No, when you have a witness that can describe and get people and their office and their style of dress and all of that accurate, you got an accurate, reliable witness there. And you look at the other religions, they don't have this kind of archaeological confirmation like the Bible. I mean, one of the shows that you do, I'm sure, is on Islam. Well, how much archaeology do we have that confirms the life and the events of Muhammad? Very little. The earliest biography we have of Muhammad is written by Ibn Ishaq about hundreds of miles away from Mecca. He's not writing in Mecca, he's writing up there in the Mesopotamia area, hundreds of miles away, I think in the modern country of Iraq there. How much archaeology is going on in the city of Mecca, which the Quran says is the oldest city in the world. When Adam and Eve were kicked out of Eden, which the Quran says is in heaven, they landed in Mecca. Mecca is the oldest city in the world. How much archaeology we got going there? Very little. It's a modern city covered in cement and buildings. Unlike the Bible, you've got so much archaeological confirmation of the events and people it records, and so we can be confident we've got a historically accurate record here.
So good, and a great way to summarize that. Well, as we normally do, we like to give book recommendations to our listeners who may want to dig deeper into this topic. So, Joe, what books would you recommend on, let's say, Herod's Temple or Pontius Pilate, Caiaphas, anything that come to mind?
Well, I re-recommended this one book last week, and it was Lean Ritmeyer's The Quest, which deals in detail, highly illustrated work on Herod's temple. It is amazing. The first and second temple, Ritmeyer was involved in the excavations and the architectural renderings for the whole area there. He is one of those great sources that somebody needs to have in their library. And then, secondly, a more popular level book, Gary Habermas, his book, Ancient Evidence for the Life of Christ, it deals with all kinds of people associated with Christ. And that was very helpful to read through because he makes things very easy to understand. He shows you the connections between Jesus and, let's say, Caiaphas and Pilate, and he goes to the different evidences there. And then third, I would do a study and put together what the extra biblical literature says about Pontius Pilate or Herod or Caiaphas. And they can look at Josephus, the Jewish historian, his works that talks a lot about these people. And then you have Tacitus, the Roman historian, in his Annals of Imperial Rome. He mentions Christ and Pontius Pilate. You can look to the church fathers like Tertullian, or look to Philo, the Jewish philosopher, or Eusebius, a few centuries after Christ, the great church historian. You have these pictures being painted of these people, and it would be very rewarding to put them together to see what others say about these individuals.
Yeah, that's great advice. That'd be a fun little study to do. Pat, what about you? Any books you would recommend on these gentlemen we talked about?
Yeah, there's a great book out called The Architecture of Herod the Great Builder by perhaps the best modern day scholar on Herod the Great by Ehud Netzer. You'll get insight into Herod that you probably will surprise you. He's one of the greatest engineers and architects of his time. That's a great book there. And then another book, hot off the press. I think it's published this year. It's by Titus Kennedy. It's called Archaeology and the People of the Bible. And it talks about people we talked about today, Caiaphas, Herod the Great, and others, in the Old and New Testament. So I'd recommend that book as well, Archaeology and the People of the Bible.
Great recommendations. Thanks, gents. Join us next episode as we continue our series on archaeology and the Bible, looking at the top 10 discoveries as we investigate the Murnetot stele and the Balaam inscriptions. Until then, may the Lord richly bless you.
Come to a close. Be sure to join us again here on Evidence and Answers. Our goal is to bring you the love of Christ. and to equip you in your faith to always be ready to give a response. If you would like to hold an apologetics conference or series of teachings at your facility, contact Pat by calling him in Hawaii. That number there is 483-0586, or email him through the Evidence and Answers website. That's evidenceandanswers.org. Be sure to browse through our listing of topics on our site. We have everything from atheism to Zen Buddhism. You will also find articles and additional audio for you to listen to or download. An additional location to find Pat's messages is on YouTube. Look up Evidence and Answers and hit that subscribe button. To keep quality broadcasts like Pat's on the air, we rely on generous financial support from you, our listeners. Donating is simple. Once again, log on at evidenceandanswers.org. Evidence and Answers is grateful for one of our sponsors, the Honolulu Christian Church. If you don't have a home church and are looking for a great place to grow in your faith, check out the Honolulu Christian Church. For service times, log in at honoluluchristian.org. Join us again next time on the air or online as we provide compelling reasons for faith in Christ. That's Evidence and Answers with Pat Zukeran.